everyone. This is Clarissa Hayes at FRAC. Thanks for joining us today on this month's FRAC After School Meals Matter call. If this is the first time you're joining us, welcome. These calls take place the third Thursday of every month and cover a new topic around program expansion and improvement. So on today's call, we're covering two topics that we hear come up quite a bit, and that's streamlining and working with health departments. So first, USDA will help kick it off with a refresher on streamlining options available for sponsors transitioning between summer and after-school meals and any additional updates from their office. And then next, we'll hear from three presenters that have developed a strong partnership with their local health departments as a strategy to address barriers to implementation around health and safety requirements. So we wanted to cover this topic because, of course, meeting this requirement is a key component to operating the after-school meal program. And a number of programs already meet the standards and do not have additional requirements. So that's the schools that run school nutrition programs and your licensed after-school programs. So for programs that do not fall into these categories, there can be a tremendous variation in the standards and what's expected. So in states with overly complicated requirements, meeting the health and safety standards is often a primary deterrent to participation. So we know that these standards should keep children safe, make sense, and not be too costly. So in places where there are no standards or the existing standards act as a barrier, state agencies should work with anti-hunger advocates and the appropriate state and local officials to either create or improve existing ones, as well as work informally with health departments on solutions. So our after-school meals program guide, which is on FRAC.org, has a lot more information on these ins and outs, but we definitely want to hear from anti-hunger advocates and program providers who have kind of worked on these solutions. So that is enough from me. We're going to get to our speakers. And this is just a reminder that we will keep questions for the end just to make it a little bit easier. So before we dive into health and safety, I wanted to first turn it over to USDA. And joining us from USDA is Laura Carroll and Andrea Farmer. So Laura is a nutritionist at USDA's Food and Nutrition Services Child Nutrition Programs. Laura develops and evaluates nutrition policy for the Child and Adult Care Food Program and the Summer Meal Program. And joining her is Andrea. Andrea is the chief of the Community Meals Branch in the Policy and Program Development Division. All right, ladies, the floor is yours.
All right, thank you so much, Clarissa. So this is Andrea Farmer, and I'll start by talking about some of the streamlined processes for people who operate other child nutrition programs and want to apply or become a sponsor for the at-risk after-school meals. And then Laura will tell you about some recent policy memos that we have just issued that pertain to the at-risk after-school program. So first, let's talk a little bit, and let me just preface this by saying that the information that I'm going to give you about streamlining and different types of sponsors is found in our at-risk after-school meals guide. We're in the process of updating this guide, so you will see a revised version of that coming out shortly. But it is very comprehensive and goes over this information. So, of course, because SFSP sponsors or school sponsors are already operating child nutrition programs, USDA has developed some procedures that will help to streamline the application process if they wish to also sponsor at-risk after-school sites. For our summer SFSP sponsors, if they are in good standing, they do not have to submit a full CACFP application. They're considered that they've already shown that they know how to, they've demonstrated that they know how to run our programs in many areas. Now, a sponsor considered in good standing would be one that is not currently seriously deficient in their operation of the SFSP. So just to kind of talk about some of the things that they are not required to provide in a CACFP application, they are not required to provide documentation that they have practices in place to ensure that the meal service, record keeping, and other program requirements are performed properly. They also are not required to submit a management plan unless they intend to sponsor more than one facility. In addition, states generally do not need to require that existing SFSP sponsors provide any further documentation that they provide benefits to unserved facilities or participants. And then there are some other areas as well that could be streamlined for a SFSP sponsor applying to CACFP. If the SFSP sites have established area eligibility through the use of school data, then that would also apply to for CACFP, and they would not have to submit anything additional. However, if the sites were established using census data, that is not cannot be used in CACFP for the at-risk program. So they would have to then go and find the school data that at least 50% of the children in that school in that area are eligible for free or reduced price meals. SFSP sponsors are also not required to submit a non-discrimination statement. They're not required to submit an additional media release if they already did one for SFSP. And then, so this is going to be discussed later, but with health and safety inspections, where the state or local health and safety inspection standards are the same for the at-risk program and the summer program, then that one inspection that was used for summer can apply to CACFP. Of course, as you all know, in many cases that is not the case, that the summer sites might be exempt or there may be differences in those requirements. And I agree that that is one of the challenges for people wanting to make that transition. So I'm really happy that that's going to be addressed later on this call. And then also, private nonprofit organizations are not required to resubmit documentation of tax-exempt status for CACFP if they already submitted that for SFSP. Now, one thing to keep in mind with these streamlining procedures, in state agencies where it's the same agency that administers both those programs, of course, this will be a lot easier. The challenge comes in, and some of you may have already experienced this, where it's a different state agency that administers CACFP and the SFSP. And in that case, those two, you know, state agencies need to be working internally together to try to coordinate some of this. And then just moving on to talk a little bit about school food authorities that are participating in the National School Lunch Program but would like to transition to CACFP at-risk meals. Again, you know, if they are successful in operating NSLP, we know that they can successfully manage our programs. So they're not required to provide any additional evidence of administrative capability or financial viability. Also, state agencies may waive the requirement for the SFAs to submit a separate management plan and budget. However, there is some additional information that is required for CACFP that would not necessarily be contained in an NSLP application. So the state agency does need to collect that additional information, and some of those things would be names, mailing addresses, and dates of birth of the responsible principals and individuals. Also, documentation of eligibility. SFA would have to demonstrate that each school that would be offering the at-risk after-school meals through CACFP offers some type of educational or enrichment activities, and also, as I said before, it needs to be a school where at least 50% of the children are eligible for free or reduced-price school meals. In addition, the SFA must provide a list of all federal programs in which they participate and certify that during the last 7 years, the SFA and the individual or individuals responsible for the food service have not been declared ineligible to participate in any other publicly funded program or convicted of any activity that indicated a lack of business integrity. And finally, the SFA must submit a certification that all information on the application is true and correct. So that's just a quick rundown in those two instances of SFSP sponsors and SFAs that would already operating programs that would like to apply to operate our at-risk program through CACFP. And now I'm going to turn it over to Laura to talk about some memos.
Hi, everyone. Thank you for having us. So I'm going to be talking about two memos that we released this summer that provide some additional flexibilities to the at-risk after-school component of CACFP. The first one is the use of shared tables in child nutrition programs, and we released this in June 22nd. So this memo extends the use of shared tables to at-risk after school in CACFP and then gives an overview of some food safety requirements that need to be followed when a operator is choosing to include a shared table in their meal service. So what exactly is a shared table? It's a table or it's a station where children may return whole food or beverage items they chose not to eat. And that food is then available for other children to take if they choose. The food that's left on that table can also be reused in another reimbursable meal at another meal service, or the operator can choose to donate that food. The use of shared tables is really an innovative strategy to increase consumption of nutritious foods for those children that want to take a second helping, but it also helps to reduce food waste. CMP operators, though, and at-risk operators need to be aware of all the applicable local and state health and safety food safety codes to make sure that the use of shared tables doesn't violate any of those codes. So we highly encourage any at-risk after-school sites that plan to use a shared table to discuss those plans with their local health department or state agency prior to implementing it. The next memo is the taking food components off-site in the at-risk after-school component of the CACFP. And this was released just last month, August 10th. And this memorandum extends the flexibility to the at-risk after-school component to allow children to take certain food items off-site. And this is consistent with the National School Lunch Program and the summer program. So this is designed, we allow this because we recognize that some children, for a variety of reasons, may want to take some food items to eat at a later time. And so this flexibility allows children to take a vegetable, a fruit, or a grain item off-site to eat at a later time. That food item must be from their own meal or snack, or it could be an item that was left on a shared table. And again, we would state the at-risk after-school institutions do not need state agency approval prior to implementing this flexibility, but again, you must make sure that it's in compliance with local and state health safety codes. Those are the two memos that we had that came out most recently about at-risk, and we, as many of you are probably aware, we did update the CACFP meal pattern requirements recently, and those go in effect October 1st, 2017. So a lot of memos have been issued in the last 4 or 5 months about those updated meal pattern requirements. And one of the provisions that we included in the updated meal patterns is allowing the use of offer versus serve in at-risk after-school programs. So we are planning to release guidance on how to use that meal service in at-risk after-school programs this fall. So keep your eyes out for that.
So thank you. That's all we have from USDA.
Great. Thank you so much for all that information. And as everybody knows on the line, these memos are available on the policy section of the CACFP part of the USDA website, but we'll make sure to grab all these and include them in our newsletter that goes out. So thank you again for joining us. And we are going to shift gears a little bit and dive into health and safety. So our first speaker today is Brooke McCauley. Brooke is Maryland Hunger Solutions Senior Manager and supports the director and staff in their efforts to end hunger, promote health, and improve the well-being of low-income Marylanders. She takes a leadership role in policy development, advocacy, and coalition building, as well as providing team leadership, staff development, communications, and project support. Brooke, the floor is yours.
Hi, thank you so much, Clarissa, and hello, everyone. So, Clarissa, thank you again for giving us this opportunity to share a little bit about the work we've been doing here in Maryland. So this work with building relationships with the health departments, it actually started several years ago, even before I came on board as senior manager. But we've had a lot of staff turnover, and then local health departments and staff at the state level as well have also experienced some turnover. So when this issue came up in spring of 2015, it was almost like we had to start completely over. Maryland Hunger Solutions chairs the state work group for after-school meals, which is part of our statewide partnership to end childhood hunger. And so one of the questions we posed to the members of the work group were, was what is one of the key barriers that you're seeing out there, that is preventing more sponsors or more sites from serving additional after-school meals, from making that transition from summer to after school. And so the first thing that came up was working with the health departments and the fact that one sponsor may be working across several jurisdictions and they may have several different sets of rules that they have to comply with, or they may not even know who the best person is to speak to at the local health department. One person at one health department may give them one piece of information, another person may give them another piece. They may be forced to go through training that a commercial restaurant has to go through in order to get certified, and they may not even be handling the food at all. They may just be offering boxed lunches. And so I did a little bit of digging, and that's when I also had some conversations with Clarissa, who was a part of the initial wave of staff here at Maryland Hunger Solutions, who began some of the relationship building. And so what we did then was we took a multi-pronged approach to this effort. And so we started at the state level, and all of this took several months. And so it took us a few months. We also had our partners who worked very closely with the Maryland State Department of Education. So we had several of our partners reaching out to state level staff at the Department of Health and Mental Hygiene. And we finally were able to connect with the lead person who helped us to move this issue forward in the past. And so in speaking with her and sharing some of our concerns, and she also brought in some of her team members, we were able to begin to strategize a little bit and open the door to some new opportunities. And so one of the first things we did was create a training. She invited us to come and speak to several of the organizations around the state that include individuals from the local health departments that are in leadership roles who should ideally affect the permitting process. And so we did a total of three trainings, one for the environmental health directors, another one for food supervisors, and then another one that consisted actually of individuals not just from Maryland but from around the region. And in the training, we brought together several of our partners. So we brought together partners who were sponsors, such as the Family League of Baltimore and St. Vincent de Paul of the greater Baltimore area, as well as Share Our Strength, No Kid Hungry Maryland, MSDE, to really create a training that was comprehensive, and it shared several pieces of information for the participants. And so it gave the basic information about the After School Meals program and its purpose. It talked a little bit about the benefits of the program and why it's important. It also offered data around food insecurity in Maryland, free and reduced price meal percentages from around the state, and then also we included some information around SNAP participation as well, just to kind of paint a picture of why these programs are so important. And then we also talked about how it worked, the difference between a sponsor and a site, and what some of the challenges had been and how can we have a greater discussion and really move the program forward. So the trainings seemed to go over well, and we were really excited about that, and then we didn't stop there. We revised a former survey because one of the challenges that our partners shared with us is that, again, from not only did from area to area the process differ, but sometimes they didn't even know what the process was in certain areas, and it was difficult to get information, and sometimes they may have sites that were trying to get certified, and then they just literally never got certified. So we updated an older form of a questionnaire, and then we sent it out through the state health department to each of the county health commissioners. And it's really funny. So it was meant to ask questions such as, you know, who are the main contacts? What is your process? What are the fees like? What is the turnaround time? Just a lot of the key basic questions that our partners share that they had. And so it was funny because no one responded to the questionnaire, and it went out twice. So I'm just saying this to say that sometimes efforts take time, and some things, take multiple tries before you get the response that you really want. So that didn't work as well as we would have liked, but nevertheless, in our follow-up meetings, we were able to use some of the questions from the questionnaire to get the answers that we needed. So we decided to take another step, and then the next step was to create, to update and create a revised form that each of the local health departments could use and each of the sponsors could share with their sites so that we could hopefully standardize the process. And so this local form that we were creating included the basic information that the local health department needs to know. What is your serving model? How many kids are coming and how many kids are you serving? What are your hours for serving? How many days of week are you serving? These kinds of basic questions were already on this form, this updated form. And then we also included with that a copy of the state regulations as well, because we didn't want to assume that everyone was as familiar with the sections of the state code that related to these programs. So we created the forms, and we did these in conjunction with MSDE. We shared them with our partners at the Maryland State Department of Education, and of course with our partners at the state level of the Department of Health, because they were able to tell us what type of language we needed to add that would speak the best to their staff. And so we know that our language in the hunger world might be a little bit different than their language. And so helping us to really make sure that the words we're using would be as understandable as possible and would, kind of get them on board with what it is we were trying to share, because language is important. So we recently sent this out, maybe I'd say in the last month or so, to each health department around the state, as well as to every sponsor around the state. And then we did a follow-up email. And in certain areas, we also, because there were a few key areas where we know we were seeing the most trouble. And so in those key areas, we have begun to do follow-up meetings with the sponsors from those areas, the health department staff, and then some of our other partners. So, for example, in one of the meetings we had, Share Strength, No Kid Hungry, and then the Capital Area Food Bank to visit with this health department and really kind of dig into what their process is, to share more about the program. And they had said that for whatever the reason, they had never seen this form in one of its past versions. And the fact that having this form available so that everyone could kind of be on the same page really was helpful. And just be able to look at the form and see these key questions already answered really would move the process along. And so they were able to share with us what the fees were, who the best people to contact, and who is that person that we should talk to should we run into trouble during this process as well. So all of those kinds of questions were answered. We were also able to lobby to get some of the fees knocked down. We're going to do some follow-up around that. And then apparently we also found out that there were some exemptions for people who were referred to the health department by the local food bank. And so what we thought about doing is following up with some county-level legislation possibly that would extend that so that anyone, any sponsor or any site that is in that jurisdiction and wants to apply should be given exemption as well, because they are all trying to do the same program. And so we're continuing. It's an ongoing process. We're continuing to see how this rollout is going to work. We also asked them to share out this information at a staff meeting because we didn't know at the time, but more than one department was involved in this permit process. And so we wanted to make sure that everyone was aware of this. And so we asked them to share this out at a staff meeting. And we also offered to create a flyer for them to share with their staff as well, so that just in case they get that call, they'll have something to refer back to. So this is very much still a very fresh issue that we're working on, and we're hoping it goes a lot more smoothly this fall. And then we scheduled a follow-up meeting, or we are in the process of scheduling a follow-up meeting. We agreed to meet maybe 45 to 60 days out, just to see how everything went during this cycle. So we got our fingers crossed, and we are excited about the possibilities.
Great. Thanks, Brooke. It just goes to show that there are a lot of different approaches and partnerships needed to kind of move this along and that it doesn't happen overnight, but small steps. So thank you for sharing that great information. All right. I'll go ahead and move to our next speaker. And our next speaker is Tony Thomas with Florida Impact. Tony joined Florida Impact in 2013 as the Food and Nutrition Programs Coordinator. In her previous role as Manager of Community Involvement at a Jacksonville, Florida food bank, she oversaw initiatives to educate and engage the public on the problem of hunger. Tony, the floor is yours.
Hi, thank you so much for having me. It's been great to hear from Andrea, Laura, and Brooke. And Brooke, I think we've had some similar experiences, and you shared some really excellent strategies. So Florida Impact is a statewide anti-hunger organization that mobilizes communities to increase access to federal food, nutrition, and other economic support programs. In particular, we focus on connecting public and private nonprofits with child nutrition programs like after-school meals and summer food, among others. And some of the ways that we work on these out-of-school time programs include recruiting and assisting prospective sponsors, as well as connecting new sites with sponsors, fostering collaboration among local organizations and agencies to better meet the needs of underserved communities and to implement innovative service models, working directly with state agencies and sometimes USDA when policy questions arise, and being sure to share with them the best practices that we see on the ground. We maintain several websites with child nutrition program information, and then there's other initiatives. For example, we partner with state agencies to co-host statewide meetings. We've developed toolkits and other resources, things like that. With all that said, I'm going to speak a little bit about the CACFP At-Risk After School Meals Program, or AMP, as we call it here for short, and some ways that Florida Impact has strengthened relationships with local health departments, as well as worked with them to address barriers to program implementation. So I'll start with some issues that we ran into around implementing after-school meals related to health and safety requirements. As Clarissa alluded to earlier, in Florida, an AMP site must either have a child care license from the Florida Department of Children and Families, or DCF, or if DCF finds them exempt from a child care license, then they must secure a food permit from the Florida Department of Health, DOH. So the latter are the ones where we were seeing a lot of questions and obstacles arise around food permits a couple of years ago. These are the same kind of food permits that other food service facilities are required to secure. And standards are set pretty high, even to get approved for something as simple as serving a prepackaged shelf-stable snack. Fortunately, the DOH Environmental Health Bureau had developed some exemptions or provisions specifically for AMP sites that can make it a little bit easier for them to get food permits. However, we were hearing through the grapevine at the time that some county health inspectors may not have known about those exemptions, and we were hearing that the health and safety inspections just seemed to differ in each county. Last, to make things more complicated, in 5 of our 67 counties, child care licensing is handled by a local licensing authority instead of the state agency DCF. So in these 5 counties, there can be additional local ordinance that affects both child care licensing and health and safety requirements. So sometimes this means you've now got 3 separate local agencies involved in these processes, or it could mean that the county health department is also responsible for child care licensing, which is not the case in most other counties. So there's a lot of variation, and it could sometimes cause confusion. So we knew that we wanted to help resolve these issues. I joined Florida Impact in our state office in Tallahassee in the spring of 2013, and over the course of the next year, I was hearing a lot of questions and complaints from prospective sites around the state about how confusing or challenging it was to secure the required food permit. There seemed to be different fees around the state, and some county health inspectors seemed to be more strict than others. So in June of 2014, I reached out to six county health department administrators in the counties where we had been getting questions. I explained a little bit about Florida Impact and asked for informal meetings with the appropriate staff where I could learn more about the food permitting process and other requirements for their counties. I ended up meeting with the health departments in person in five counties, and I spoke with a sixth over the phone. And in most cases, I was speaking with the environmental supervisor or inspector. For these meetings, I developed a list of questions that I brought with me and that I can provide to FRAC to share after this call. So I asked about things like what process sites should follow to apply for a food permit, what the anticipated time frame is from start to finish for steps like submitting a plan review and scheduling an inspection. I asked about infrastructure requirements for food permits and different levels of food permits. I asked about local and state fees, and also just opened it up to them for any words of advice based on what they had seen and learned from sites applying for food permits. In two of the five counties that I visited, these counties were the ones with local licensing authorities, so I was also able to learn more about their unique processes. And when I went into these meetings, I also brought with me the list of those AMP exemptions that I mentioned earlier, so that these inspections would be sure that they, you know, so that I could be sure that they knew that AMP sites could be treated a little bit differently than other food service facilities in some cases. So these meetings were very positive in tone, and I was sure to be very open to listening and learning from the county health departments. Our field staff, who are located in other counties around Florida, also arranged a few more of these meetings with additional county health departments after the meetings that I had. So I think that these meetings were really helpful for establishing relationships and really putting in that face-to-face time. You know, just helps build a rapport for future communication. The county health departments were able to learn more about Florida Impact. We were able to learn more about any variation in local processes. And we spoke to them about after-school meals so that they really understood the value of the program. Of the meetings that I participated in, the one that was most effective was in Hillsborough County, where Tampa is located. It was a little bit different than the others. Because at that time in Hillsborough, multiple sponsors and sites were in the midst of struggling through this food permitting process. So we asked the county health inspector to come out to a site and meet with a group. And the group included both a Boys and Girls Club and another local nonprofit that were looking to become sponsors, and the City Parks and Rec Department, which was looking to bring on some of its locations as sites. There was also a United Way representative there who funded some of those organizations and was familiar with the problems that they'd been encountering in trying to get these food permits. So the inspector came and not only talked us through the health and safety inspection process, but did a walkthrough of the facility where we met so that he could show us exactly the kind of things that he would be looking for in a real inspection. He also established himself as a contact that they could reach out to at any time, and he was really friendly. So we got great feedback from the group about this meeting afterward. And that person at the county health department did continue to be an important contact when questions came up later. After these meetings, we compiled everything we had learned about food service inspections and put it on our website. We always think that it's really important to capture the information that we learn and make it accessible to others around the state. Outside of those meetings, we've also worked with DOH and county health departments over the years in other ways to resolve issues related to health and safety. So I'll mention one more strategy that we found to be effective. In one of the counties where there is a local licensing authority, we felt that sites were getting conflicting information from local agencies about the processes involved in child care licensing and food inspections. So Florida Impact reached out to all the local agencies involved in these processes to get a better handle on who was responsible for what. And then we created a flow chart and asked all of the local agencies and the State Department of Health Office to sign off on its accuracy. We've also asked them to sign off on other information that we put on our website, because again, we really want to share information that's not always real easy to find, but we also want to make sure that it's accurate, and there's sort of some extra accountability when everybody signs off on something. In that same county where we developed that flowchart, Florida Impact's local program coordinator has continued to do a great job of maintaining her relationship with the county health department. So she'll connect potential sponsors with the County Health Department and broker meetings with them that she'll also attend. She makes an effort to stay in communication with her county representative periodically. So, for example, she'll check in annually to review that flow chart and make sure that it's still up to date. And actually, just a few days ago, she met with the County Health Department to receive clarification about the requirements for a scenario that's new to us. So if a school district sponsors its own schools for AMP meals on weekdays but cannot provide meals on weekends, it's possible for another sponsor to take on just the weekend component. And that's something we've been helping coordinate this year, but there are some nuances involved related to child care licenses and food permits if you follow this scenario that we wanted to better understand. So my colleague was able to sit down and talk through the details of that process with her contact at the County Health Department. So I'll conclude with just kind of recapping my general advice from these experiences for developing relationships with health departments. I think scheduling the in-person meetings was very helpful. I also mentioned I had conducted another interview over the phone, which was also useful. But just establishing that rapport and being open to learning from them can make a huge difference. Or if you have a connection with an anti-hunger organization in your state that has this kind of relationship with county health departments, they might be able to assist you too. I think even more helpful was having the inspector come out and do a brief run-through with a group of organizations so that they could see firsthand what to expect and they could ask questions and just feel that they had more of a relationship with the county health department. I think it's helpful to get information in writing and to kind of save it all in one place. This can really help identify where there still might be confusion or misinformation that needs to be resolved. So, you know, when we are working on that flow chart with multiple state agencies, you really are able to start nailing down where is the conflicting information coming from, and let's get to the source of the true answer. And I guess I would just conclude by saying that I'm still not an expert on health and safety regulations by any means, but these processes have helped give me a better sense of who to turn to when questions or problems come up so that I can find the right information when I need it. And that's really a big part of Florida Impact's role when it comes to providing technical assistance. If you're interested in learning more about AMP in Florida, you can check out our website that I mentioned earlier. It's floridaafterschoolmeals.org. And, of course, I'll stick around for the Q&A. Thank you for having me today.
Thank you, Tony. So Florida Impact, like Tony mentioned, has some really wonderful resources, and all the questionnaires and the forms that Tony mentioned are available. So I'll make sure to collect those and the resources that Brooke mentioned and send them around after the call. All right. With that, we are going to go ahead and move to our last set of speakers, and we're going to kind of shift from the anti-hunger perspective to the actual program provider perspective. So joining us today is Rachel Phillips and Jenna Katsaros. Rachel started with the City of Aurora in 2015, helping implement the National League of Cities Combating Hunger through the After School Meal Program grant. Rachel now serves as nutrition specialist in the Parks, Recreation, and Open Space Department, where she oversees operations and opportunities for expansion of the federal meal programs for youth. All right, Rachel and Jenna, the floor is yours.
Perfect, thank you. I just want to start this all with our building is getting worked on, so if you hear any banging, the painters outside, I do apologize. Like Clarissa mentioned, we are in Aurora, Colorado. And all of this really started with the CHAMPS grant last year. And one of our biggest obstacles, I would have to say, was probably the health department. And it started with a little bit of research. We had a lack of sponsors and a lack of quality food. We didn't have hot or cold options. A lot of it was shelf stable. The kids didn't necessarily find it appealing, though it definitely served a need. And looking into why the sponsors that we did have, looking into why they were only serving these shelf-stable meals, we found out that it was largely our local health department. And digging more into that, we realized that our health department did require a retail food license to operate both CACFP and SFSP. And this process was relatively lengthy and included needing a site plan, including all of the surface materials that the food would come in contact with, including like the floors and the counters. They needed to know every ounce of information about the water heater and if we had a three-compartment sink or not. And they were really held up on this three-compartment sink piece. And then once we gave them this application to get this retail food establishment license, we would then need to request a variance because we didn't have the three compartment sink. So it was this big, long, hairy mess for just wanting to serve kids food. And that's when we looped in our anti-hunger organization, Hunger Free Colorado, and they did most of the legwork for us, which was absolutely fantastic. They released a few memos and findings. They looked at our county health department, which includes our county and the two other surrounding counties, and then they looked at other counties and how they handle these child nutrition programs. And they found that there was a lot of ambiguity and variance across all of the counties within the Denver metro area. Some of the health departments were completely on board with food banks preparing these meals, having them hot or cold, and then going out to locations. And then other directors thought that all of these programs were catered programs. So it was two very different ends of the spectrum. And largely it came down to a lack of knowledge of these federal food programs and really what our goal was and how we wanted to make sure that food safety was our number one priority as well as their number one priority. And our health department actually suggested to us that we should only do prepackaged meals with extended shelf lives, because we didn't meet the retail food establishment criteria. So our health department educated the health department on what these fresh meals were. They came prepackaged from a licensed kitchen. They came refrigerated. They went directly into refrigeration. And per state requirements for both SFSP and CDCFP, they were coming to us no less than an hour before we were serving them. And ultimately, our goal of creating these programs aligned with our health department's vision of optimal health across the lifespan, and really framing that to say that proper nutrition for these kids leads to healthy kids that are ready to learn and grow into healthy adults. So magic happened. I can't tell you exactly what happened, but the health department ultimately designated a point person for these student feeding programs. And it started as she would ask us 10 questions, and I have those. I can send those off to Clarissa. But things like, what types of food are you going to be serving? How will they be prepared? How will you serve them? How will you keep them hot or cold? And it really came down to, how are we going to keep the milk cold? That was their strong point, is how are we going to keep the milk cold? So we have well thought out answers, and we sent that off to them last summer with the guidance of the City County of Denver, who never had these issues with their health department. So now we have one woman who I email every time that we have to start a new SFSP or CDCFP cycle, and I say, hey, we're going to do these sites at these times. I'm requesting a health department review, and she sends us a letter saying that we are not a high enough need for them to send someone out. And that letter meets the state requirements of having the health department visit. We're not a high risk. Sorry. Jenna just chimed in. We're not a high enough risk for food safety for them to send anybody out. Because all of our meals are prepackaged, we tempt them at three points along the way before the kids get them. We have commercial-grade refrigerators, commercial-grade heaters. We take food safety very seriously, though we still have a few holes to fill. The largest one is that we are in the process of opening a new rec center, hopefully next year. And their health department guy came out and said, well, you need this three compartment sink and this retail food establishment license. So it was a lot of us educating our staff internally to say, hey, we don't need these. This is our point person. And really educating not only our staff, but staff that we might come in contact with from the health department And just kind of looping everybody in and reminding everybody that this is ultimately for the kids to make sure that they're getting taken care of and not going hungry.
Yeah, this is Jenna. I would just add to reiterate that we found it's really on the sponsor to make sure if your health department isn't on board, you really need to reach out and educate them on what your program looks like because they don't know. And you know, we can't expect them to know, but, you know, Hunger Free Colorado was a great advocate meeting with all the different county health officials and talking them through it. So without their help, we may not have become a sponsor because we did not want to serve shelf-stable meals in Aurora. So we'll be available for questions later.
Great. Thanks, ladies. It just kind of goes to show about the education happening on all levels. And if you are a sponsor or provider on the call and you want to connect to your anti-hunger organization, if you're already not doing that, I'm happy to help with that connection. But they can be a really great partner for moving this work forward. So thank you all to our speakers for your wonderful expertise and joining us today. I'm going to go ahead and open up the line for questions. If you want to email me your question, you can feel free to do that. Again, my email address is chayes@frac.org.
The conference is no longer in lecture mode.
All right, so the lines are open for questions for any of our speakers today. And we did have a couple that came over email, so I'll go ahead and ask those first and give folks time to think of a question. But the first question we got is for USDA, and this question is about the traveling apple policy. And the question is, does this apply to both snack and lunch service if a site provides both?
Hi, this is Laura Carroll, and yes, for the traveling apple memo, it would allow a child to take a food item from their lunch, their snack, and take that off-site, as long as it's from their own meal or snack.
Great, thank you. All right, so another question that we got over email, I think that this would go towards Brooke or Tony. The question is, do any sponsors help sites cover costs related to health and safety?
You know, I'm trying to remember. What I've heard. Early on, kind of when I was going through this process, we also had a CHAMPS grant in Tallahassee, and I remember that there was some discussion of, you know, shifting some funds around from the CHAMPS grant that were going to be used for one thing, which the food bank sponsor had been the recipient of that grant. And we talked about using that toward covering the cost of some of these inspections. But I'm actually, that is a good question, and I can check with our field staff for a little bit more follow-up on it, whether it's a common situation for the sponsor to help cover these costs.
Great. So we can do a little bit more digging on that question and send information around about that. Okay, so the lines are open if anybody has any questions. Oh, all right, we had one come through. All right, I have a school who currently runs the community eligibility provision for universal meals. They want to begin to run after-school meals program. Can this CACFP application also be streamlined?
Can you repeat that question one more time? This is USDA.
Sure. And I think I was just asking about the streamlining for schools that are running programs. So the question is, I have a school who currently runs CEP. They want to begin to run the after-school meal program. Can this CACFP application also be streamlined?
So the same streamlining flexibilities for school food authorities, I think this is what the question is, would apply to that school, but if they're talking about the eligibility piece, they still have to meet that 50% requirement. So it depends on, in that case of a CEP school, they'd be looking at their individual ISP, and it would have to be for that school. So I don't know if those are really exactly answering the question that they had, but the streamlining requirements in terms of the application would be the same if it's a school food authority that's operating NSLP. That wouldn't make a difference whether, you know, that school is a CEP school or not.
Awesome. Thank you. And I think we might just have to follow up with this question afterwards just to make sure we're on the same page.
Okay.
All right. Last call or any questions on the phone?
Yes, actually. Thank you so much. I'm not sure exactly who to address this to. My name is Tricia, and I am working with an existing nonprofit organization that has more than a dozen after-school programs, primarily for at-risk kids. And the programs themselves are held at this public school. However, they're not run by the public school. And I've been brought in to pursue healthier, you know, what I'll call healthy snacks for these kids, and looking to see what may be available to provide from an outside third-party vendor and reimbursable by the government, and have not really had success in finding an avenue for that. Would anybody have an opinion or a new contact for me? And, you know, with respect, just in all respect to what the USDA and the DOE is doing to provide, meals and snacks, I'm trying to offer, you know, even better, even more nutrition.
So just so that I'm clear, are you already a sponsor in CACFP for the at-risk program or not?
No, have been told that we're not eligible for CACFP.
Okay. So, of course, not knowing your individual circumstances, we wouldn't really be able to comment on that. But what you would want to, you know, if you want to pursue that further, you would need to work through your state agency that administers CACFP. You can go to our website. You can just go to the USDA website, actually, usda.gov. And so there's links to child nutrition programs and then to the child and adult care food program. So you can find information about the at-risk program there, and it also will give a list of state agencies. So you can find the state agency that administers a program in your state. And you would want to work through them.
Okay. Well, I will dust that off. And I will attempt to do it again. There are a number of agencies, of course, and I have just found that there's not tremendous amount of clarity in quote unquote working with, and you know it doesn't seem to be a clear path to see what avenue might be possible. But I will pursue it again,
This is Clarissa at FRAC. If you want to shoot me an email, chayes@frac.org, I can connect with you and we can talk offline about this.
Thank you so much. That would be lovely. That would be wonderful. Thank you for both of your input.
All right. So I'm going to give folks a couple more minutes if for any questions, but I'll just go ahead and remind everybody that today's call will be recorded and you can find it on our website by the end of this week. Next month's call is going to be on partnerships and activities for weekends and holidays. So definitely register for that if you're interested. And I think if we are out of questions, I'll go ahead and end today's call. Thank you, everybody, for joining us and our speakers for sharing your great expertise. And enjoy the rest of your day.
Thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.